including the president himself. About 3 weeks before Kennedy was assassinated, Clayton saw the president in New York at a time when Adlai was the ambassador to the United Nations and Clayton was his deputy. The three men were together at a party, and Clayton was helping himself to a drink on the balcony overlooking Central Park when the president came up behind him and said, "We haven't had a chance to talk much tonight, but we've got a good subject in common," meaning Adlai. The president then told Clayton he didn't understand the hold Adlai had over women, commenting on how much Jackie liked and admired him, and confessing that he himself didn't have the ease with women that Adlai had. "What do you suppose it is?" he asked, adding, "Look, I may not be the best-looking guy out there, but for God's sake, Adlai's half-bald, he's got a paunch, he wears his clothes in a dumpy kind of way. What's he got that I haven't got?" Clayton's response hit on what I think women saw in Adlai, and what they shied away from in other men of that era. "Mr. President, I'm happy to say that for once you have asked me a question I'm prepared to answer, one I can answer truthfully and accurately. While you both love women, Adlai also likes them, and women know the difference. They all respond to a kind of message that comes across from him when he talks to them. He conveys the idea that they are intelligent and worth listening to. He cares about what they're saying and what they've done, and that's really very fetching." The president's response was, "Well, I don't say you're wrong, but I'm not sure I can go to those lengths." I spent quite a lot of time that fall of 1961 working on Lally's coming out party to be given at my mother's house over the Christmas holiday when Lally was home from college. I adhered to the 26th of December as the night for a big party, because my mother had given annual gala parties that night as each of her four daughters came of age and made her debut. Mother, who tended to deal harshly in her appraisals of others, paid me the first lavish compliment I remember receiving from her. She looked at me one day during the preparations for the party and said, "Darling, you are very good with lists." At the party there was a happy mixture of our friends, some of my mother's friends, and of course a great many of Lally's. Grown-ups wore white tie, the young wore black tie. Don, Bill, and Steve wore their best suits, and Steve went through the receiving line several times. Susan Mary Alsop recalled how handsome Phil and Lally looked as we all stood back, and he waltzed Lally from one end of the ballroom to the other. They were the best-looking, most lovely couple I ever saw, and the most dramatic, with Lally's black hair flying, and he so fine. It was indeed an enchanting evening, and one of our last really good and happy times. Chapter 16. For all their busyness, the first 6 months of 1962 had a certain stability and comforting routine to them. Phil still didn't feel very confident and didn't trust his instincts. One day he said he had an idea, but it couldn't be a good one because it was his. A young Otis Chandler had taken over the Los Angeles Times as its publisher and had ambitious plans to develop it from a partisan and mediocre paper to an independent one of quality. Phil saw the chance to get together with Chandler and form a news service, with each paper adding to the number of its correspondents abroad and perhaps helping pay for the expansion by selling the combined product to 25 or so other big papers. Otis reacted favorably, and Phil and I went out to California to advance the plan, and the Los Angeles Times Washington Post News Service was launched successfully that year, with 32 initial subscribers. It has since grown and now goes to more than 600 newspapers, broadcast stations, and magazines here and around the world. On July 7th, Phil and I left with Chip and Avis Bolin for a week's vacation to the lodge in Nova Scotia owned by Bowater Mersey, which supplied the Post's newsprint. The trip with the Bolins was memorable in part because Phil seemed well and in balance. Only once during the week did he ask me to take a walk and talk to him because he was a little down. He still needed help, but my main thought was, how marvelous! He's well again. He's recovered. What we didn't know during the trip was that Chip had been notified by President Kennedy that he was going to be appointed ambassador to France. Chip and Avis were extraordinarily discreet, not saying a word. Avis was reading Camus' La Peste in French, which might have tipped us off, but didn't. We had no sooner gotten back from Canada than the appointment was announced. A few days later, we went out on the president's boat for a dinner in honor of the Bolands. The guests were all on the open fantail of the boat when Kennedy's car pulled up. There was a largish circle of friends sitting on folding chairs, and the only unoccupied chair was one next to me, so the president had no choice but to sit in it. I looked at Phil, silently imploring him to come over and help, but despite knowing of my nervousness at talking to the president, or perhaps because of it, he just looked at me and smiled sympathetically. My insecurity was exacerbated by my feeling that the president had been forced to sit next to me. Nevertheless, we began chatting. He wanted to know about the Bolands' oldest daughter, Avis, who was a very able young woman. Now one of the stars of the Foreign Service, she has just been named ambassador to Bulgaria. I told the president that she was an extraordinary girl and that she was writing a book on Peter the Great. "I wonder if she's been around her family too long," he inquired, referring to their long diplomatic career. I knew what he meant. Avis was somewhat shy and retiring, but I reiterated that she was a terribly nice girl and how much I liked her. He looked at me quizzically and said, "Oh, we like nice girls, Kay." The day after the boating party, Phil and I left for Florida, taking Steve with us for the dedication of Bill Graham's project, Miami Lakes, the planned development of the original family farm, which eventually became a community of almost 25,000 people. Something very significant happened to me while we were in Florida. I had been feeling that Phil, after 5 long years, was finally better. His depression seemed gone, and he was growing more interested in work again. What baffled me was my own mood. My emotions seemed to be changing from 1 week to the next. I was happy in Canada when we were with the Bolands, but I found myself in tears much of the time we were in Florida and had no idea why. It was only later that I realized it was Phil's sudden mood change that had so affected me. The little walk we'd taken in Canada to overcome his momentary depression had been the last time he'd been calm. It is clear to me now that the almost imbalance period was suddenly over, and that one of hyperactivity, with its accompanying anger and vitriolic diatribes, was beginning. I have since learned that manic depressive cycles, when left untreated, tend to grow more severe and occur closer together. What I was experiencing was a quickening and an intensifying of these cycles. One thing he did was begin to buy things, some sensible, some less so. In addition to part of the Bowater paper mill, which he had more or less negotiated while we were on the boat returning from Canada during a shuffleboard game with the head of the mill, the first week in August he bought the monthly magazine Art News, the oldest continuously published art magazine in the world. Phil considered the purchase not a big investment of dough, nor a big bother of time and energy, but considerable fun and prestige, and a reasonable profit, so all very pleasant. Essentially, he bought it for me, thinking I could be involved with it in some way that would fit my growing interest in modern art. Phil's increasing need to be always on the go resulted in a hastily planned summer trip to Europe with the children, from which we returned in time for Don to head off to Harvard. He had graduated that June from St. Albans, a year younger than his class, but close to the top. Phil's advice to him on departure was clear and unusual for a newspaper man. "Stay away from the Crimson. You have lived in a journalistic atmosphere, either at our house or the Friendlies. You've edited the St. Albans News. You ought to study other subjects to broaden your horizon." Don waited 3 months before trying out for and making the Crimson. From then on, it constituted much of his life at Harvard, and he eventually was its president. Our own routine resumed after Europe, with the difference that we were going out more and Phil was working harder. He pulled off a significant coup by signing Walter Lippmann to write a fortnightly column for Newsweek and The Post to be syndicated by The Post. This was a stunning development, since Walter's column had been appearing in the Herald Tribune since 1931. Despite his advancing years, Lippmann was still the preeminent commentator, and the column was a distinguished asset, much quoted and very influential and a great boon, especially for Newsweek. At the same time, Phil signed up Emmett Hughes for a weekly column for Newsweek. Oz Elliott, however, had not been told about this arrangement and was none too happy that Phil had hired Hughes without consulting him. The pace picked up still further. Phil was pressuring the president on two subjects. For one, he argued that Dean Rusk should be removed as Secretary of State and replaced with David Bruce. The other subject, a tax cut, met with a more sympathetic reception. Phil was convinced that there was a need for a tax cut to boost the economy. He made his arguments in a long, well-reasoned letter to the president that makes it clear that his mind was still functioning brilliantly. From October on, Phil was increasingly given to impatience and anger. Besides working constantly to improve the Los Angeles Times-Washington Post news service, maintaining his trusteeships at RAND, the Committee for Economic Development, and George Washington University, and keeping his hand on the tiller at the Post and Newsweek, he had several other balls in the air. He had undertaken a major speech, which he hadn't done for quite a while, agreeing to address the 25th anniversary dinner of the Washington Building Congress. He spoke of the full-blown crisis facing Washington, saying that the Year 2000 plan for the city was being used as an opiate by planners and by out-and-out obstructionists to tranquilize us against our day-to-day and year-to-year problems. The speech was positively received. Even the Star covered it and editorialized that Phil had delivered an eloquent and perceptive analysis of the shortcomings plaguing the nation's capital. Incredibly, Larry Stern, a Post reporter who had helped draft the speech, also covered it for our paper. One interesting sidelight on this dinner is that the executive secretary of the organization had written to Phil beforehand, inviting me by saying, "One way you can tell that the Washington Building Congress is getting older is that it has decided that the ladies should be invited to share the head table with their husbands." Phil sent this to his assistant with a note. "Call and say Kay will be delighted, and then tell Kay how delighted she is." This peremptory message from Phil says something both about his mood and about our relationship. It also says something about the role of women in those days. It was assumed that I would go where Phil wanted me, and in fact I assumed it too. In October, Phil took on a job that changed both our lives and sped us up even more. He accepted an invitation from President Kennedy to serve as an incorporator of the Communications Satellite Corporation, known as ComSat, with the understanding that he would be elected to head it, and in mid-October he was appointed chairman of the group. ComSat was a groundbreaking public-private organization, half-government, half-telephone company. Getting it launched, in essence translating an exciting vision into a working, financially viable organization, was a full-time job, requiring massive organizational skills, infinite tact and patience, and a huge amount of time and energy. It was not what Phil needed at that time, but it was what he wanted, an irresistible temptation to be engaged in an exciting venture that would, in fact, alter the shape of the world. Simultaneous with Phil's appointment to head ComSat, there was an ominous development abroad. Signs of a crisis emerged at a dinner party Joe and Susan Mary gave on the night of October 16th, a send-off party for the Bolins, who were about to leave for Paris. Joe had wanted President Kennedy to attend the dinner to show the French that this ambassador was important to the president. Besides the Alsops and Bolins, there were only a few guests, the president and Jackie, the French ambassador Herve Alphon and his wife, Isaiah Berlin, who had come down from Harvard, where he was teaching on an exchange program, and Phil and me. The president had just that morning received the first pictures of Soviet missiles being erected in Cuba, but he had decided to keep his normal schedule and attend the dinner. When he arrived, he barely greeted anyone before he led Chip out to the end of Joe's garden for a long talk. It appeared to some of us who glanced out that they were arguing. Joe began to think they'd never come in and started pacing, but just when Susan Mary was convinced the meal would be ruined if it was held up any longer, they returned, and we all sat down to dinner. The president was sitting on Susan Mary's right. "I felt extraordinary tension," she later recalled. "I've never felt anything like it. It was a physical sensation. I felt I was sitting by a very high-powered motor, which was revved up to its fullest powers." The other thing that struck her was that the president, who so rarely repeated himself, so rarely monopolized dinner conversation, asked the same question twice, first of Bolin, then of Berlin. "What have the Soviets done historically when their backs are to the wall? How do they behave? Joe remembered the president as being in a brown study the whole evening. When the men separated from the women, as they regularly did after dinner, he recalled Kennedy saying, "Of course, if you think simply about the chances in history, you have to quote the odds as somewhere near even that we shall see an H-bomb war within the next 10 years." When the men rejoined the women, the president again took Chip into the garden, where they stood talking. Finally, they came back, and the president left, apologizing that he had an early and hard next day, and still arguing with Chip as he went down Joe's front steps. This was at the start of the Cuban Missile Crisis. Chip was a member of the team Kennedy had assigned to advise him, and the president, it turned out, had been urging him to stay home and remain part of this executive committee. But knowing that a change of his plans might tip off the Soviets, Chip advised the president that he and Avis should sail the next day as arranged. Joe reflected later that this showed what a real pro Chip was, sacrificing his own participation in the crucial event of the decade for what he thought was the greater good. The president, still keeping up the appearance of normalcy, left for a scheduled weekend of political campaigning. He was in constant touch with the executive committee, then pleaded a cold and returned from his trip to preside over the XCOM in its final debate. The course was decided, a blockade rather than a military strike, which had also been considered. By the weekend, the story, kept so tightly secret all week, started to leak. The New York Times noted troop movements and other activities and prepared a story by Scotty Reston. When Scotty checked it with the White House, a plea by the president to Times publisher Orville Dreyfus got the story killed on the understandable grounds that, according to Arthur Schlesinger, publication might confront him with a Moscow ultimatum before he had the chance to put his own plans into effect. By October 20th, the Post began to get wind that something was going on. Al Friendly was giving a dinner at his home when Walter Lippmann phoned to say that something serious was up. Friendly called Murray Marder at home and then went to the office, from where he called Arthur Schlesinger at the White House. Schlesinger said only that everything was tense and tight. This, plus the fact that the president had returned from Chicago with his alleged cold, was all we had. Marder then did a brilliant piece of reporting. At that time, there was a check-in book at the State Department, which no longer exists because of this very story. Marder observed that two people from the CIA had just checked in. He thought this was odd on a Saturday night. Certain that a crisis was at hand, but not knowing where, he raced around the department and found that the only lights on were in the Latin American Bureau and the Bureau of International Organization Affairs, which included the United Nations, and of which Harlan Cleveland was assistant secretary. Running into Cleveland, Marder had to think quickly of a question that might elicit a useful answer, which an open-ended one like, "What's going on?" clearly would not. So he asked, "How bad does it look to you, Harlan?" To which Cleveland replied, "Well, pretty bad." By that time, Marder had eliminated the idea of Berlin or the Middle East and guessed Cuba. Hoping to get Cleveland to confirm his guess without asking him directly, Murray asked, "Is it going to be like last time?" referring to the Bay of Pigs, "where you're going to be in on the crash landing but not the takeoff? Are you people in the loop this time on this Cuban thing?" Cleveland said, "I think we are." So, on Sunday, October 21st, the Post published a story about a crisis that appeared to be centered in Cuba. President Kennedy blew his stack. He had fended off the Times, which actually had about half or three-quarters of the story, and here, out of the blue, came the Post, to which nobody was paying much attention. Apparently, Kennedy called Phil that day and asked him to move the paper away from targeting Cuba. Unaware of this, Charles Roberts and Murray were racing around town trying to put together whatever they could. Phil, in Al Friendly's office, called Marder in and asked him if he was sure he knew what he was doing. When Marder told him what had happened the night before, Phil said, "Oh my God, is that all it's based on?" Murray went back to his typing, and Al said we weren't sold on the Cuba angle, so we were going to take it out of the lead. To this day, Murray says he doesn't know what President Kennedy said to Phil or what Phil agreed to, but clearly Phil wanted the Post to stop focusing on Cuba. The next day's story ran under an 8-column banner, "Major U.S. decision is awaited." Martyr, without a byline, began. Official Washington yesterday wrapped itself in one of the tightest cloaks of secrecy ever seen in peacetime, while key policymakers worked out a major international decision they were forbidden to discuss. At the White House and the State and Defense Departments, officials refused to confirm or deny reports published in the Washington Post yesterday that Cuba is the focus of the extraordinary operation. That day, Monday, October 22nd, President Kennedy briefed congressional leaders and spoke to the nation in the evening, revealing Cuba as the locus of the crisis. Bill Walton and a friend, Helen Chachevetz, who were to dine with the Kennedys, watched the speech at Bill's house in Georgetown and then tore down to the White House to be there by the time the president got upstairs from the basement broadcast facility. Bill recalled telling Kennedy that he had given a very impressive peace speech, to which Kennedy replied, "But right now, we are just listening and praying. We don't know what's going to happen." At that moment, a White House aide drew them aside and said, "If there is trouble, you and Miss Chachevetz will be whisked off with them, and you'll just have to go," which meant going to a protected facility in the countryside built especially for the president. Helen burst into tears, sobbing that she couldn't go because she had left her two small children at home with a nanny. "I can't go. I won't go," she said. The aide quieted her by saying, "In fact, we think it will be all right." Phil behaved perfectly well throughout the Cuban Missile Crisis, except perhaps for carrying out Kennedy's wishes too literally. But it was a hard call to make in view of what was at stake. My own reaction was one of concern for the world, but I didn't really believe it would come to all-out war, and cannot remember feeling any personal fear. The prospect of nuclear war seemed more unreal to all of us than it actually was. At about this time, Phil made two more significant purchases, accelerating the buying trend so typical of this phase of the illness that no one had yet named. Only later did I learn that buying things is a well-known symptom of manic depression. In the first case, he saw a classified ad in the Post for a farm about 5 miles from Glen Welby in Hume, Virginia, a farm that consisted of 365 acres and a house, all for $52,000. Phil sent for an aerial photo, and without even visiting, asked his lawyer to take care of everything so that he would only have to sign the final contract. He accomplished the whole purchase in just 2 weeks, with a $26,500 down payment, $20,000 of which was provided, ironically, as it later turned out, by me. I'm sure I had no logical reason for acceding to the idea of acquiring a second farm. No doubt I agreed to it because I agreed to almost everything. I certainly understood that we didn't need a second farm, but I believed that Phil had to be mollified. I also was fully aware that he'd often bought things about which I'd had doubts that turned out to be good acquisitions in the end. As usual, I thought, who am I to question this? Phil also decided to purchase a big, expensive plane, a Gulfstream One. Normally, people ordered this kind of plane months ahead of delivery, but Phil wanted it so immediately that he took the model the Grumman Company used for demonstration purposes. It was my mother who suggested we think about the consequences of having a plane at our disposal. She wrote Phil, "Let me utter one caution about the plane. It is bound to speed up your lives far more than did the automobile in former days. You both need to protect your physical resources more than do other people with duller nervous systems. A great future lies before you, which your beautiful partnership will make as joyous as it will be important to your country if you will both keep watch on your own and each other's health." Mother was still totally unaware of Phil's problems, but was staunchly brave and supportive later, when, alas, she necessarily learned of his illness. Toward the end of October, the ComSat incorporators held their first meeting. The need for haste in dealing with the beginnings of ComSat contributed to the frantic pace of Phil's life and to his anger with anyone and anything that got in his way. He began to look for a chairman for ComSat and turned to our friend General Loris Norstad, who was soon to retire as Supreme Allied Commander in Europe. Phil pushed hard to get him to agree to take the ComSat job, even involving the President and Secretary of Defense McNamara in trying to convince him. Phil also wanted Frank Stanton, his fellow RAND trustee but still CBS president, to become ComSat's president and operating head. On November 2nd, I flew up to Idlewild with Phil to see him off to Europe, where he was going to talk to Larry Norstad about ComSat. Early the next day, Phil and Larry in Paris both wrote letters to Stanton. Phil felt such urgency about co-opting Stanton that he decided to send a personal messenger to ensure that the letters reached Frank in New York. Late on the afternoon of November 3rd, Frank's secretary buzzed him to say that there was somebody waiting with a message for him. He said, "Just take the message and I'll get it later." But the secretary insisted, "No, she wants to see you." According to Frank, a young woman then came in, sat down, and said, "Here's something Mr. Graham wanted me to give you." Frank thanked her and put the letters on his desk, intending to read them later. She said, "Aren't you going to read these? I came all the way across the ocean with this message. You ought to look at it." The appearance in New York of this young woman, whose name was Robin Webb, was the beginning of the tragic end. I have only been able, in later years, to piece together some of what had happened up to that point and what happened in the ensuing months. Larry Collins, then head of Newsweek's Paris Bureau and later a well-known author, had received a call from Phil asking to have a secretary on a standby basis for that November weekend. Larry sensed that this was important and that it had to be someone he trusted, that he couldn't just call a secretarial service in Paris. The office secretary's English wasn't good enough for dictation, and he knew that Robin, who was a Newsweek stringer, could do the job, so he called and asked her to fill in. Robin was actually quite an able journalist, Larry recalled. "She was Australian. She was very much one of the boys, a little bit matey. She was fun and very nice. Drank a fair amount in the good Australian tradition. A nice kid is what you would say. Worked very hard and did very well for us." When Larry called her, her first response was, "I'm not a secretary, I'm a journalist." To which Larry said, "Come on, don't be stupid. This is going to give you a chance to know the boss." She agreed reluctantly, but insisted that Larry never ask her to take dictation again. Phil later told Collins he had borrowed your secretary for 48 hours to deliver the letters to New York. He also mentioned he had told Robin that once she got there, she could use his suite at the Carlisle and relax and enjoy New York for a couple of days before returning to Europe. The connection between Phil and Robin had been just that quick. On November 5th, Phil himself flew back to New York, where I met him. We came home to Washington, and then he flew back to New York the following day, went to Newsweek for an editorial conference, saw Frank, who had never really been interested in the job, and, most important, picked up Robin and flew to Glen Welby with her. And so it began. I don't know how long she stayed in the United States, but when she returned to Newsweek's Paris Bureau, she was discreet about the relationship with Phil, though it was clear, according to Larry Collins, that she was on cloud nine. When Phil came back from Glen Welby on that Friday, November 9th, he skipped some scheduled RAND conferences, but did attend a meeting at the Post. That night we went to the White House for dinner. The next day, Phil and I took my mother in the Gulf Stream to Hyde Park for Eleanor Roosevelt's funeral. After their rocky adversarial early relations, my mother and Eleanor Roosevelt had grown very close, a really intimate friendship involving many mutual interests, both personal and political. They were both in somewhat the same mold, very strong, cerebral, emotionally complicated, and fundamentally lonely. My mother was deeply saddened by Mrs. Roosevelt's death. She had only 2 tickets to the funeral, so Phil escorted her to the service, while Steve, whom we took along with us so that he wouldn't be left alone in Washington, and I waited for them in the Poughkeepsie airport. Phil's behavior grew more and more erratic. Things were getting very bad and much more public, but we all excused his angry, aberrant moods as signs of exhaustion. He was doing a great deal, and a great deal of what he was doing was still very good. At the same time, however, he began to turn on everyone around him with incredible explosions of anger. Blow-ups directed at Russ and Al were particularly extreme and became more regular, but both men covered up, so that others at the Post weren't aware of either their frequency or their severity. Max Eisenberg, an old classmate and colleague whom Phil had recruited to work with him on ComSat, recalled one day when Phil gratuitously turned on him. Nothing had stimulated him. He just wanted to be abusive, Max said, which seems typical of the explosions that were becoming habitual. Max also later told me that, around the time of the embargo of the news on Cuba, they were in Phil's office when Phil got a phone call from the president. Max started to leave, but Phil told him to stay, and he heard Phil talk to the president as I have never heard two French truck drivers in an accident talk to each other, and the president did not hang up. Phil was becoming more intolerant and offensive, using foul language to excess. During the summer of 1962, he had started to direct his angry outbursts at me. But there was worse to come. In mid-November, he met with the incorporators of ComSat on what turned out to be a traumatic occasion. At one point, probably toward the end of the afternoon session, according to Max Eisenberg, Phil turned to him and said, "Moose," Max's nickname, "take over. I'm going to the Metropolitan Club to get a massage." And he walked out. That session was adjourned fairly soon afterwards, and everyone went off to dinner at the F Street Club, where Phil rejoined them. It was here that one of the board members, Vern Litchi, responding to a press release that had been prepared that afternoon and which concentrated on relatively minor appointments of personnel and consultants, suggested that it was very important that the public know that you're having stellar personnel, and that's a policy of ComSat, but I think we ought to have a policy statement of some kind very soon. At that point, Phil became abusive and lunged across the table as if to strike Litchi. People were aghast, and Phil was escorted out of the room. Everybody was baffled. No one knew what to do. Several of the incorporators stayed there talking until about 2 a.m. Phil came home and recounted the story to me, telling me how this man had pushed him beyond endurance and that he felt he had to go away for a rest and to regain his calm. The very next day, we made hasty plans to leave for Palm Springs, though when we got there, he decided he didn't like it in California, so we packed up and left for the Arizona Biltmore in Phoenix. We took with us on this trip Liz Hilton, who had been recruited from the accounting department by Phil's secretary, Charlie Paradise. She had been unhappy in accounting, and Phil had brought her in as number three in his office. Liz remains with me to this day, my invaluable assistant. After only a few days away, Phil wrote to Litchi, managing to work in some of his resentment against the man, and only half backing off. "I realized that the conventionally proper form after an outburst of anger such as mine would be to write a note of apology and to ask you to forget the episode. But after 5 days of rest and sun and contemplation, I am not going to be so conventional, because to do so would be so patronizing and inhuman and insincere. I shall say this. It is very regrettable for anyone to flare as I did, but I think it is equally, more, regrettable for anyone to act as woodenly, unimaginatively, and frustratingly as you have acted as incorporator. Enough of that. I have told myself that you are perhaps under strain by reason of being new to being on boards. I have told myself you may simply be one of those unfortunates who utterly lack a sense of humor or a spirit of imagination. But it is not for me to presume to make such patronizing analyses of you. Don't fight being angry. Emotions are more helpful to useful human actions than they admit in Harvard Law School. And you are entitled to be angry over my mean and hyperbolic blast. I want sincerely to apologize to you, and then go on and work with you, in agreement or in direct, manly, outspoken disagreement. Heaven knows there is room for lots of disagreement in this matter. And direct, open disagreement can let in light and lead to sensible solutions. And I will apologize to you and work with you when I have heard a forthright expression of your grievances and any acknowledgement of your possible lapses you may care to make." A couple of weeks later, Phil wrote Litchi again, this time opening with an honest self-analysis of this incident. "I fear I am like some deep-sea animal who cannot rise quickly to the surface without excess decompression. In any event, my rise has been slow. My first letter to you was just part of the gradual decompression. Now I wish to say that I have thought through the situation, and now I can with complete honesty say, 1, I wish to apologize fully. 2, my behavior was inhumane and unpardonable. 3, I cannot plead mitigating circumstances because I don't believe in them for such bad conduct. I also want to say that you have behaved yourself in a most gentlemanly way. I hope and believe your example will be contagious as far as I am concerned. I look forward to working with you." It's impossible to know whether time or a third person brought about this change in view. Apart from dealing with some correspondence and business, mostly ComSat-related, Phil and I had a comparatively quiet time in Phoenix, playing golf and resting. In the middle of the first week, Phil asked me to go with our plane to the Lockheed Field in Burbank, California, to tell the people there how to redesign the interior, which was due for refitting in early December. Our showroom model plane had partitions with cutouts of dancing girls and come-to-Hawaii motifs, all of which were to be taken out and replaced, and I was to choose the fabric and design. Phil also suggested that while I was in California, I should call my sister Flo and meet her for lunch. Initially, I protested, thinking it would be too difficult to arrange, and saying that in any case we were supposed to go to Los Angeles the following week to meet about the news service, so why bother now? "Call her," Phil insisted, "and if necessary, meet halfway." So I did. Flo and I met at the Brown Derby and had a long, touching, memorable lunch. We talked intimately about our parents, with her railing at great length about how much she disliked Mother, who, she complained, had succeeded in breaking up Flo's most important early romances, one with David Green, whom I had known at Chicago, and one with Drew Pearson, who had been judged not suitable by my mother. Flo viewed that particularly bitterly, given that Mother later became a great friend of Drew's. Flo was so obviously sad and tormented by all these events in the distant past that I finally said, "Wouldn't you be happier if you put all this behind you? After all, you are 50 and she's 75. Isn't it time?" My question had little effect. She remained adamantly negative about Mother. Ours, however, happily for me, was a close and loving exchange. Except for the unhappiness about the past, she seemed well. When I left her, we were both looking forward to our return to Los Angeles in a week or so, and seeing more of each other. 4 days after our lunch, a messenger came and got me in the middle of a golf game to say that Flo had died suddenly. As far as anyone knows, there was no warning. Grief-stricken as I was, I felt and remain grateful to Phil for insisting that I call her for that lunch. We immediately flew to Los Angeles. Again, Phil rose to the occasion and was the greatest help in every way to Flo's boys, Vincent and Larry, and to me. I was deeply fond of Flo. She was so beautiful and funny and literate and sad. She adored her boys and had brought them up carefully and closely. I will never be able to appraise the strange relationship she had with the Halperns, who seemed to have such a strong hold over her. After Flo's death, they produced a letter signed by her, saying that if anything happened to her, they, the Halperns, were to have the boys. Soon after the funeral, the Halperns left for Europe without telling any of us, taking the boys with them. Flo had had a bitter divorce, and the eventual settlement excluded her husband from her boys' lives. He remarried, and I think took no interest in them. After that, it became next to impossible to see or know the Homolka boys, until the younger one, Larry, returned home and married his high school girlfriend against the Halperns' will. Vincent lives in England and relates to Mrs. Halpern. I've seen him only once. He gave most of his money away and lives a Spartan existence. After Flo's funeral, we went back to Phoenix, and the night before we headed home, had drinks with Harry and Claire Luce in their house, which adjoined the Biltmore grounds. Despite the few weeks of rest interspersed with a certain amount of activity, Phil's mood was agitated. At dinner that night, he removed Claire's plastic shoes, declaring them to be unworthy of her. Then, as we were leaving, he picked her up and carried her to the car, clearly a reflection of his fundamentally aberrant behavior. Only the superficial effects of all Phil's activity, the news service expansion, the purchase of Art News, the acquisition of Walter Lippmann's and later Joe Alsop's columns, ComSat, editorial and business decisions at Newsweek and The Post, buying the airplane and the second farm, were evident to the outside world. The last week of November 1962, Time ran an article about Phil titled The Acquisitor, in which the reporter asked if there were any more columnists to come, to which Phil responded, "Well, I could have had another big one, but I didn't want to seem greedy." The article also quoted Phil as saying, "I'm looking for another TV station or two, and maybe a pulp mill." December brought with it a quick return to the old heightened level of activity. Phil, still trying to get a team of people to take over the leadership of ComSat, flew back and forth to New York several times in the next week and had another important meeting with the incorporators in New York on December 10th. This time he received a telegram from Sam Harris, effectively Phil's vice chairman, saying, "I knew that you could do it. Congratulations. Let us continue to reason together." Phil himself thought this third meeting went quite well. As he wrote to George Killian, a ComSat incorporator who had not been able to attend, "At least I did not repeat my offer to hit anyone." At the same time, Phil took part in some important RAND meetings, which he hosted at the Post. I've never been clear what he was engineering for RAND, but he received a telegram from its vice president saying he had heard that Phil's superb performance saved the day. The country, the Air Force, and the people who are RAND all won. I can assure you at least the latter group will not soon forget. We'll strive to merit your success. Here was yet another demonstration that, even in the midst of this darkening scene of hyperactivity, rage, and irrationality, Phil still retained much of his ability and got significant things accomplished. On December 13th, he went to the White House to meet with President Kennedy to report on space communications issues and a few other matters, and the next day he flew to Europe on ComSat business. It was on this second trip within 5 weeks that Phil reconnected with Robin Webb. On the official schedule, she was described by Phil as Newsweek reporter and temporary personal shopper, tour director, and femme de chambre for our group. I had no idea what was going on in Paris, except that I thought Phil was engaged in a very important task. Soon after he came home, we settled in at our R Street house for the Christmas holidays. Phil had grown increasingly to dislike Christmas, and gradually I had taken over everything having to do with it, decorating, planning, gift-buying, parties, especially since his years of mood swings. That Christmas Eve afternoon, the world I had known and loved ended for me. The phone rang and I picked it up, not realizing that Phil, too, had picked it up in his dressing room with the door shut. I heard Phil and Robin talking to each other in words that made the situation plain. I waited until he had hung up and went right in and asked him if what I had surmised was true. He said it was. It's hard to describe my total devastation after my discovery of the affair. This kind of thing has happened to innumerable people of both sexes, but I had never dreamed it could happen to me. I knew that marriages could endure momentary disloyalties, but this was different. It's very hard to understand, even in retrospect, how the possibility of his having an affair had never occurred to me. I was so blinded by the closeness of our relationship and by what we had been through together in the last years. My feeling that something fundamental had been destroyed was a result of my own total commitment and my belief that these feelings went both ways. Also, it was part of my bafflement at what I saw as Phil's increasingly strange behavior. I had no understanding of the context of the terrible depression he had come through, or the polar opposite mood that was dominating him at the time. Not even then had anyone bothered to utter the term manic depressive. I truly believed that he and I were bound together by time, by choice, by shared experiences, by our family, and by the life of the company that was so important to both of us. Phil was clearly upset, too. He told me that he wanted to preserve our marriage and our family. He said that he loved Robin, but would tell her the affair was over and that he would stay with his family. It was a memorable Christmas holiday. I was wrenched apart by finding out about the whole thing, and Phil was torn at having decided to end it. He knew a breakup would be terribly difficult for Robin, so to help her recover, he sent her on a vacation in the sunshine and even sent along a friend of his to keep her company. The friend turned out to be another girl from his past, about whom I, of course, had never known. For some reason, in those immediate days after my discovery of Robin's existence, Phil seemed to have a compulsion to tell me much more than I wanted to know about this side of his life, of which I had been happily oblivious, about his past relations with other women, of whom there apparently had been several. I was, of course, shattered, as well as completely stunned to learn of his interest in others, including some of my own friends to whom he had made approaches, and Robin's companion, with whom he said he had had a long, strange relationship. Of the children, at first only Lally knew that something was wrong. She had planned to go skiing in Aspen with friends over the holidays, but Phil told her what had happened and asked her to give up her trip and stay home while we all tried to get our bearings, which she heroically did. A sad, small, but symbolic event took place during this time, which seemed to me to be the nadir. We were at Crescent Place, and my mother gave me some long, pretty paste earrings of hers. It meant a great deal to me. She was not very forthcoming about that kind of thing, and it had never happened before. Phil said, "You don't wear long earrings, and Lally does. Give them to her." How could I have simply obeyed? But I did. I handed them to Lally and went out by myself to the pantry, where I burst into tears. I suppose I didn't have the strength to resist and just quietly laugh and keep them, which any normal person would have done. To me, it was symbolic of losing everything. I felt ultimately demeaned. During the few weeks after I found out about Robin, Phil drank a great deal, and there were many problems, overlaid with our attempts to hold things together and keep our lives going. One night before the end of the college holidays, and so before Lally and Don went back to school, I had an especially hard time with Phil. We were at home, and he had had a lot to drink and was saying some wild things, most of which were not very rational. I finally got him to go to bed, but not until around 2 in the morning. When I came out of our room to turn off the lights throughout the house, I saw Don, looking spectral and drawn, sitting at my desk in the room right next door to the bedroom. "How long has this been going on?" he asked, referring to Phil's drinking and the row. I confessed that it had been for some time. "Why have you never told me?" he asked. Should I have told him? Who knows? We all try to protect our children, and my natural response was to keep this from them. I don't know that I was right. Perhaps it's better to share problems with children as they grow older. We somehow got through the nightmare holiday season. Phil and I were both trying to make things work, to keep up some semblance of normalcy, even as our personal world had fallen apart. We attended some dinners and went out a few times. I remember one evening going to a musicale at the Frankfurters. On our return home, Phil reprimanded me for looking so dejected and drawn when we were trying to conceal things. At the beginning of January, Phil went to New York for a meeting of ComSat, which he was still running, and running well. He had breakfast with Larry Collins, who was leaving for Paris, telling him, too, that he was very much in love with Robin, but wanted to get his priorities straight and keep the family together. We were both just moving numbly through our days. Phil wired Lally at college about a routine matter, but it ended with, "All is very well here. Much love to you, Pa." At some point, however, not quite 3 weeks after Christmas Eve, the phone started to work again between Phil and Robin. On January 12, 1963, after dinner, Phil and I had an argument. I can't remember what precipitated it. The upshot was that he walked out of the house holding a blanket, got in the car, and drove away. I had no idea where he'd gone. He later told me that if I had come after him, he would have come home. My response was that I hadn't known where he'd gone and still didn't know.
"Where would I go?" he replied. "The office, of course."
By this time, Robin had returned to Paris. Phil called and told her to come back to America as soon as she could. Evidently, she protested, saying that she was just beginning to recover and that he had been right the first time. They should end the relationship. He said that if she didn't come, he would come and get her. According to Larry Collins, Robin thought that Phil was in a really bad state and that she was the only person who could really talk to him, so she decided to come back. Robin Webb behaved well throughout. She was as much caught up in the tragedy and a victim of it as the rest of us. She was obviously mesmerized by Phil, charmed out of her mind, and she couldn't have understood the background. Phil flew to New York the day after he walked out of the house. I sent him a telegram reflecting my own despair. "Mascots are for loving, helping, and listening. You are stuck with me as a mascot, repeat mascot. The moment of happiness you gave me is more help than most people are given in a lifetime. Thank you for it. I'm here if you need me, and I love you. Phil wrote me back a pretty strange letter.
Dearest Kay, one morning, when you were despairing, I tried to help you by words. I told you how lonely it had been when I had visited my far country, and how I could not get near enough to help you in your far country. And by the words, you came near enough for help, and I touched you, and we went for a walk, and were again in life. I have now gone not to my far country, but to my destiny. It happens to be a beautiful destiny, and I shall be there while it is beautiful and while it is not. I did not go to help you. I did not go because I did not want to help you. I went because it was my destiny, and by not helping you, I believe and I pray, I shall help you. I loved you, and I shall always love you, and I love you too much to be false about major matters, and while you need help, you will be getting it from me, now and always in this new but loving way, and you shall help me. Love, Phil.
He added a P.S. saying,
Les will know my plans.
Farber again. I wonder still what Farber must have advised Phil. Lally called Larry Collins in Paris, told him of Phil's departure for New York, and asked where Robin was. Larry called her apartment, and when he got no answer, checked with TWA and found she was indeed on a plane flying to the United States. And so it all started again. Phil welcomed Robin with a carload of flowers, and together they flew to Sioux Falls, South Dakota, where Phil and I had been scheduled to go, and where he was to make a speech to the Chamber of Commerce and to talk with a publisher of the local paper, the Sioux Falls Argus Leader, about buying it. George McGovern, then senator from South Dakota, flew along on this trip, and he later told me about the flight, on which Phil and Robin sat separately, and Phil wept a good deal, and spoke of loving me. The three of them were met by the publisher of the paper, who said he had heard great things about Phil, to which Phil replied,
I hear you are a son of a bitch.
Naturally, there was no sale of the paper. I had told no one about Phil's departure, not even my mother. Finally, fully 2 weeks after he had left, I couldn't hide it any longer. I also felt the need for consolation from someone, so I walked down the hill to visit my friend Lorraine Cooper and told her what had happened and that Phil had left. Expecting the sympathy and commiseration of a friend, I was startled when she said, Good! What do you mean, good? I replied. It's terrible. No, Lorraine responded firmly. You'll be better off without him. What do you mean? I asked, incredulous. Don't you realize what he does to you? Don't you realize he puts you down all the time? That you are the butt of all the family jokes? She gave me several instances. Though I didn't agree totally, I got a glimmer of what she meant. But Lorraine didn't understand the other side, that he had also built me up. I literally believed that he had created me, that I was totally dependent on him, and I didn't see the downside at all. From Sioux Falls, Phil and Robin flew to Phoenix, where many of the nation's most prominent publishers were gathered for a meeting of the Associated Press. Otis Chandler and his wife Missy met Phil and Robin at the airport. According to Otis, who told me all of this only much later, Phil was disheveled and spinning out ideas, some of which Otis found interesting, and others of which were unintelligible. It was clear to him that Phil was not well. He said that from the moment he first saw Phil, he began to worry about how he was going to handle the dinner that evening and what he could do to help Phil get through it. Otis was unsure if it was Phil's mental state, or if he was keeping himself perpetually drunk, or both, but certainly Phil was making very little sense. He had even gotten upset over the Chandlers not staying right next door to him and Robin at the Biltmore Hotel. Also, by this time, there were a lot of four-letter words. At the dinner, when Ben McElway, editor of the Star and president of the AP, rose, Phil stood up and went straight to the lectern, where he began to speak. He started out saying some nice things about the Star, but his remarks quickly degenerated, turning into nonsense interspersed with ugly language. No one present that night has ever told me exactly what happened, or what Phil said. Reports of his obscene comments have appeared in several books. But at the time, those who witnessed this sorry spectacle seem only to have talked among themselves. As with other outrageous behavior by noted or known persons in those days, the incident was hushed up and not reported. Apparently, though, Phil's wild remarks attacked individuals as well as the press in general. Nobody knew what to do. Finally, Ben McElwain's wife went up and managed to get him off the platform and back to his seat, but not before he had begun to take off his clothes. Otis and some other men got him to his room. From there, Phil actually called President Kennedy, and incredibly must have gotten through to him at a late hour on Eastern Time. Soon Otis had Phil banging on his door saying, "Come and talk to the President." When Otis said, "Phil, you didn't wake up the President, did you?" he responded, "Yes, he's a buddy, and I want him to meet and talk to Robin." Otis called John Hayes, the company's head of broadcasting, who also happened to be at a meeting in Phoenix, and got the message through that Phil needed to be taken out of there and back to Washington. Someone, I've never been sure who, reached President Kennedy, who agreed to the use of a government plane to transport the doctors to get Phil, for the situation was described as extreme. By then, Phil had made telephone calls all around the country to many people, some close and some whom he hadn't seen in years. One of these calls had been to me. It was the only exchange I ever had with Robin Webb, and was a sensitive one. She said, "I do love him, but you were there first." One of the most important calls Phil made was to Lally, who adored her father more than anyone in the world, but who was a pillar of strength and stability to me then and throughout all those terrible months, at the same time as she was trying to be understanding with her father. She was always loving but firm with both of us. At this point, she called me from Cambridge and said he needed her, and she thought she had to go. Since at that point it had been decided that Dr. Farber and a fine Scots psychiatrist, Ian Cameron, whom Farber had brought in to consult, were to bring Phil home, I was reluctant to have her go. I understood her desire, but hated her being there for what was sure to be an ugly scene. Her response was adamant. "I'm his daughter, and he says he needs me, so I have to go." I couldn't help agreeing. Don drove her to the airport in Boston, and on an impulse got on the plane and went with her. The doctors had decided to try to get Phil to return to Washington voluntarily, and if not, to bring him back forcibly. I gather that Farber initially tried to read him passages from Martin Buber, and when this failed to work, they forcibly tranquilized him and put him on the plane. Under the strained circumstances, Robin was sent away with too little care and attention. When the plane landed in Washington, there was an ambulance waiting and another scene in a small private terminal at National Airport. At this point, Phil simply walked away and had to be talked back by the children. The three of them then got into the limousine, and the doctors drove off in the ambulance without their patient. He was taken first to George Washington University Hospital and later to Chestnut Lodge, a private mental hospital in a suburb of Washington, selected by Farber. Phil viewed this whole sequence of events, with some reason, as a violation of his rights and civil liberties. As he was being taken out of George Washington, he loudly proclaimed who he was and what was being done to him, and that he was a prisoner. Once Phil was installed at Chestnut Lodge, where I considered him safe, I wrote to President Kennedy, thanking him for being a real lifesaver, and telling him that the hours that the government jet had saved the doctors turned out to be critical as the situation snowballed so rapidly. No one involved could have lasted that much longer without serious harm being done in some way. I also thanked him for his kindness toward Phil, saying, "He would and will die at the thought that he might have hurt you in any way. I hope he didn't, too much, and was awfully relieved to hear you understood," and concluded that I knew Phil would recover. The president realized, however, that Phil couldn't continue with ComSat. He had Clark Clifford work through Les Farber to get a letter of resignation from Phil, which Phil signed 3 days after arriving at Chestnut Lodge. The president wrote Phil a routine public note saying, "I appreciate very much the devoted service which you have given to this exacting task, and with great regret accept your resignation effective this date." He also wrote a more personal note, showing, as always, his sensitivity and concern. "I understand you are back in Washington. I hope that you will rest for a while, get feeling well again, and then come back to work, as we need you. Best of luck." The president answered my note that same day.
All of Phil's and your friends are strongly with you and are hopeful that things will now go better. No two people deserve it more.
Phil was seeing Dr. Farber daily at the hospital, and Dr. Cameron when Farber was called out of town to visit a dying older brother. When the two psychiatrists and I were meeting with post-executives, all deeply concerned about Phil, Cameron threw a bucket of cold water on the group by saying,
"I don't understand why you all care so much about this man."
As an outsider who didn't know Phil, he was reacting to everything he was hearing about Phil's behavior. I must say that remark shook us up. In meetings over the next few days, Farber and Cameron confessed to me that they were puzzled by my refusal just to give up at some point, by my protestations that I was a one-man dog, and my unwillingness to accept that Phil might have left me for another woman, and my emotional belief that I could never love another man. In a way, they were right to ask the questions, but in a way not. It may be unusual to think you can never love another person, and they certainly thought it suspect, but at the time it was true for me. Phil's brother Bill came up from Florida to be with him and to represent him at this time. He stayed a few days, making an important phone call to Robin and being enormously helpful to both Phil and me. Phil wrote him on January 27th, thanking him for electing yourself older brother pro tempore, and adding, "I am doing my steady best to relieve you of the latter responsibility with all deliberate and prudent, patient, cautious, thoughtful speed." After a few days at the lodge, Phil began going out to Les Farber's office for visits. Only 5 days after he had been flown back from Arizona, I saw him for the first time at Farber's office and drove back to Chestnut Lodge with him. I went again the next day. We talked for a long time, and he told me in great detail both how terrible the scene had been at George Washington University Hospital and how kind and wise had been the people at Chestnut Lodge who had talked him down to his present fairly cool state. Phil told Bill Graham of our talks, saying in his January 27th letter, "Kay and I are having especially good talks, the first free from any lies and deceit on my part in a good many years. She is still, as you know, very tired, and more deeply wounded than you may suspect." We talked a lot about what had happened. I felt rocked to my foundations by all these events, but I knew I had somehow to endure them, difficult as that might prove to be, and I still hoped and believed that we could restore our relationship and keep Phil functioning and the family together. I suppose the repeated experience of seeing him resume his life after periods of depression encouraged me to believe that things would once again be all right. Phil was also reading and thinking. He reread an article by Martin Buber on guilt and quoted a few passages to Bill, saying, "No one other than he who inflicted the wound can heal it." And then he says that a man who has done evil must, one, with a broad and enduring wave of light, find self-illumination about the sum total of his guilt. Two, even after he has long passed out of guilt, to persevere in humble knowledge that he is the same man as the man who was guilty. Three, and then proceed on to reparation of the wounds he has caused. Those wounds cannot be called back or wiped away. The wounds can be healed in infinitely many other places than those at which they were inflicted. At the moment, I am correctly placed to experience one, and I am getting there not by orders or instructions, but by having a quiet time and the help of doctors and nurses to permit me to get myself to full confession on my own. It is my first experience with confession, humbling and strengthening, and I shall, older brother, keep working. After about 10 days at Chestnut Lodge, Phil went to see Dr. Farber 3 days in a row. I don't know whether I was deluding myself or whether it was some sort of denial, but I actually thought everything was going well and that Phil was once again on the road to recovery. I even wrote our good friend Cy Sulzberger on January 31st that things are working out both well and quickly, as you fondly hope. You can certainly write Phil any time, and I can get it to him. Or in fact he may be home by the time it arrives, as he is very much better. Clearly unbeknownst to me, almost simultaneously with my naive letter to Cy, Phil must have been having very different thoughts about the future. On the last day he visited Farber, Farber released him from the hospital. On February 1st, Phil came home briefly, and the next day, a Saturday, he went to Glen Welby with Don and Al Friendly. However, on February 4th, he traveled to New York with Edward Bennett Williams and Charlie Paradise and went straight to Idlewild Airport, where he met Robin once more. This time, Phil saw his departure as final, something he may have been planning all along, since he later wrote to Clark Clifford, thanking him for your goodness to Robin during our embattled 2 weeks. Only you and Frank Stanton and the Commander-in-Chief seem to have remembered that gentlemen should be kind to ladies, even young and beautiful ladies. He also said that he had sweated my way out of that jail sanitarium via a doctor's discharge, although I was tempted to get a lawyer and some quick habeas corpus until I thought of the kids and the publicity. Then I learned there were plans to shove me back in after I had Robin en route to the U.S. again. At that point, I called Ed Williams. I wanted to call you, but you will understand I could not involve you because of some other friends and clients you have, referring to the president. Phil did engage Ed Williams as his lawyer and firmly stated his intention to divorce me and marry Robin, announcing this in letters to his friends as well. To Jean Monnet, Phil explained his absence at a dinner in New York by saying, I would have been at your dinner but for the fact that I was temporarily jailed. I am now out, and you can tell Sylvia that I am extremely happy and fully back at work. In addition to my journalistic duties, I am giving considerable attention to a young Newsweek reporter, Miss Robin Webb. It is my hope to get a divorce in the reasonably near future and to marry Robin. Soon thereafter, we hope to have a meal with you and Sylvia, if we are invited. Phil also wrote a patient he had gotten to know at Chestnut Lodge, saying that he missed him and the other patients and would call on them as soon as he could arrange to. He encouraged one of the patients to write to him at the Washington Post, explaining, after 3 days of returning home and a telephone call to Robin Webb in Paris, I realized what I wanted to do. She came over on February 4th, and we are living in New York in separate apartments on the advice of lawyers, and go for weekends to my funny farm near Hume, Virginia. I hope to get a divorce so that we can marry before too long. Phil knew that he controlled the Post because my father had given him the majority of A shares. He felt he owned it because he had worked for 17 years to make it a success. So from his point of view, the paper was his. He contrived a plan, which quickly got back to me, of paying me off by buying back my stock with Post money. He and Robin would then be in charge. In some ways, this was the bottom moment for me. Very confusing, very difficult, and very painful. Not only had I lost my husband, but I was about to lose the Post. I saw his plan as a logical aspect of his illness, and I knew he was really ill. But by now, the effect was real, and I was frightened. I was also terrified by Ed Williams's new role as Phil's lawyer. I didn't know Ed very well then, but I was aware of his reputation as a successful criminal attorney and litigator, and I envisioned terrible court scenes and battles. I had to face facts. Phil was really gone. He had left me for good, and I had to come to terms with this devastating reality. It was almost more than I could bear. My feelings about the Post, however, were very clear. My father had indeed given Phil the major part of the stock, and Phil had run the company well, but it was my father's financial backing that had enabled the Post to build a new building and later to buy the Times Herald and ensure its future. It was the millions invested in the paper by my father that enabled it to survive the years of losses. It was my paying all our living expenses that had allowed Phil to purchase his stock with his income from the Post. So my bitterness about his plans was extreme, and my intention to dig in was total. I was not about to give up the paper without a fight. I needed a lawyer. As head of the company, Fritz Beebe, Phil's friend and mine, had to be neutral in all this, so the Cravath firm, our estate lawyers, sent me to the respectable and able Whitney North Seymour of Simpson, Thatcher, and Bartlett, who advised me just to sit tight for the moment. Although I was prepared for the roof to fall in on me, nothing actually happened for the next few months. There was no movement toward divorce, despite all Phil's talk about it. Ed Williams told me later that he had advised Phil not to move right in with Robin, but to live separately and to wait, that you couldn't walk out of your house one day and ask for a divorce the next. Although I wasn't directly talking with Phil, I was always aware of his and Robin's whereabouts, either through other people's reports or through his calls to the children, which began soon after he left. He took Robin to Florida to meet his father, who, as Phil reported in a letter to Clark Clifford, promised Robin he'd live long enough to come to our wedding, even if the divorce took 2 years. Phil and Robin returned from Florida to settle in at the Pearson farm, the farm he had bought in the fall of 1962, with my help. There he began to build ponds and, in essence, to reproduce the life.